What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. You think you live in a pretty safe place, but you just heard about a break-in 4 miles away, which isn't close, but it isn't far either, you know? Art Palpitations is on the scene.
I sure am, Tammy, and I don't even know why I drove out here, because as you know, you got customized renter's insurance through Geico, so your stuff is covered.
Oh, well, that's great. Any sign of crime there, Art?
Just some light littering, Tammy, but like they say, a little litter can lead to a lot.
Wise words. It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.
There's something very interesting to me about the backrooms. The backrooms are interesting, I think, because they feel designed, but not designed for us. They're almost too artificial to be nature and too meaningless to be human. We've got the fluorescent light and the damp carpet, the yellowed walls if you've seen the movie or played the games or seen the images circulating online, hallways that appear to go somewhere but only lead into more hallways. You have all of these office spaces without workers and rooms without any apparent purpose, bizarre angles and strange doorknobs coming out of nowhere. A building after the people have vanished, and yet the building continues to operate as if it didn't even need those people in the first place. Instead, they were fuel for it. The building consumed them. And I think that's the true terror. Not that you are alone in the architecture, but that the architecture will claim you and keep you if you enter it. The modern internet gave this fear a name. They called it the backrooms, because the myth of no clipping out of reality and slipping through some unseen seam in the world and landing inside an endless service corridor behind existence is quite literally that feeling of being captured by architecture and not being allowed to leave. You don't enter the backrooms through some kind of gothic gate or elaborate entrance. You don't cross through some cursed forest or descend into like an obvious cave mouth marked with signs or bones or symbols or sigils. You fall through a very ordinary wall or a floor or a basement. You go down a hallway that has no corridors, and yet you get lost. A shopping center, a room that you have seen 1,000 times, but suddenly it feels different, as if it is also seeing you now. And once you're in, the problem is not simply that now you have to escape from this place. The problem is that you are disoriented. Everything becomes discombobulated. The problem is the meaning, if you ask me. Every surface suggests human activity in the backrooms, but no human story remains attached to it. The place is not ancient. It feels modern, and yet somehow much, much older than you. It feels alive. It isn't something that would normally be considered sacred, and yet it is inspiring a sort of awe from you. It's not necessarily alive, but it behaves like a predator. And this is why the backrooms feel new and ancient at the same time, I think. They aren't just some modern internet horror trend. They are the old labyrinth myth. The backrooms is the equivalent, the modern equivalent, of the labyrinth, returning in the only architectural language that modern man still believes in. To understand the backrooms, we have to go backwards. Not just to the internet, but to Crete, to history, to King Minos, to Daedalus, to the Minotaur, to the first great horror of artificial space. In Greek mythology, the labyrinth was built by Daedalus, the master artificer for King Minos of Crete in Knossos. It wasn't built as entertainment, though, as it might sound like it was. It was not some decorative garden maze for the king to sit in and look at his flowers. It was a prison designed to contain a secret. At the center of this prison was the Minotaur, the half-man, half-bull monster born from the corruption of a royal house and the punishment of the gods. The creature itself is deeply horrifying, but the deeper horror is the political nature of this venture. The monster isn't wandering the wilderness. It is hidden beneath civilization itself. It isn't outside the palace. It is something that actually belongs to the palace. And that kind of changes the whole meaning, if you ask me. The labyrinth is the architecture of concealed guilt from this perspective. Minos cannot simply kill the creature because the creature is tied to his own house, his own shame and his kingdom. So he does what power often does with its monsters. He hides it in the system. He builds a structure that is so complicated that the secret can be kept alive without ever being seen. The labyrinth becomes a literal technology of denial. Now, Athens, according to the myth, is forced to send young men and women as tribute to Crete, where they are fed to the Minotaur. And this is not just another monster folklore story. It is a symbol of ritualized submission. The maze becomes an engine of terror that extends beyond the island of Crete. A whole political order is maintained through these sacrifices, and somewhere below the shining world of kings and courts and ships and treaties, the children are disappearing into a structure from which nobody returns. This labyrinth, as you can see, is very close to the concept of the backrooms. The backrooms also function as a place where people disappear into the infrastructure. There is rarely a clear villain at the doorway. And if you look at the movie, you are the villain at the doorway in a strange kind of way, but you are a villain unto yourself. In Dante's Inferno, Dante does not treat the Minotaur as some kind of distant mythological ornament. He places him at the broken edge of the seventh circle, where the violent are punished. And the creature appears in Canto 12, and he's guarding the descent into the realm of blood, brutality, suicide, blasphemy, and war. And Dante calls him the infamy of Crete, which is brutally compact. The Minotaur is not merely a monster, but the living disgrace of an entire mythic civilization in this context. He is the result of corrupted desire and royal deception and animal lust and human ingenuity that has been turned toward sin. Before Dante and Virgil can pass, the Minotaur thrashes in rage and ends up biting himself like a beast that cannot even master its own violence. Virgil ends up defeating him, not by force, but by recalling his memories. He taunts the Minotaur by reminding him of Theseus, the hero who killed him with Ariadne's help. And this is important because the Minotaur isn't only physically trapped in hell, he is psychologically trapped in the wound of his own story. So the mention of Theseus makes him collapse into rage, and while he's distracted, Dante and Virgil pass by. Now, I think that moment says almost everything you need to know about this beast. The Minotaur is strength without reason. He's a rage without any discipline. He can't control it. He will damage himself. That's how little control he has over his rage. His flesh has no order. He cannot control his body. He's terrifying, but in the way that he attacks himself, he's also pathetic because he's still ruled by the same irrational impulses that produced him in the first place. In Purgatorio, Dante never appears to name the labyrinth outright, which is kind of weird because the poem is already filled with all these other tales of classical ghosts and moral warnings, ancient moral tales and whatnot. But the labyrinth is still present in a quieter, more buried way. In Canto 26, Dante invokes Pasiphae, the queen of Crete, who, according to the myth, entered the wooden cow designed by Daedalus so she could mate with the bull. And from that unnatural union came the Minotaur. And from the Minotaur came the need for the labyrinth. So even though Dante does not say labyrinth in Purgatorio, he places the reader pretty much at the entrance to the myth, and he gives us the origin wound. And I think the parallel of this to our own sin and the beast system is pretty obvious. I mean, the bull throughout time, for some reason, has been a massive idol unto those who would ordinarily worship God. In essence, the backrooms are almost a lesson in sin and idolatry. And that makes the reference feel more psychological and spiritual than just architectural. In Inferno, the Minotaur appears as a quite visible monster. But in Purgatorio, the monster is a memory, a desire, and a moral consequence of succumbing to sin. The labyrinth is no longer a physical maze that has been built under King Minos. It becomes the inner structure of disordered appetite and unbridled lust. Pasiphae's sin isn't presented as some sort of mythological trivia. It's a warning that when desire breaks away from reason, it will begin to build prisons around the soul. And in that sense, purgatory itself can be kind of viewed as a sacred anti-labyrinth. Not necessarily a place where souls are trapped forever, but a difficult upward path where the old maze of sin is slowly undone. Now, taken together, the Minotaur in Inferno and Pasiphae in Purgatorio, and you have two halves of the same symbolic system. Hell shows the monster, the beast, after desire has fully hardened into violence. Purgatory shows the earlier moral disorder being purified before it becomes monstrous. The labyrinth, even though mostly unnamed, it kind of sits behind both scenes like the hidden architecture it is. It is the structure that sin builds when the soul loses its way and succumbs to idolatry. First, desire is distorted, and then the body obeys, but then shame requires concealment. Therefore, concealment becomes a prison, and finally the thing hidden at the center begins to rule the entire house. This is the beast system. There is rarely a single priest demanding any kind of sacrifice or somebody hunting you down. Instead, somebody slips somewhere, they glitch, they cross a threshold, and then the system absorbs them. The ancient version has ships arriving with tribute and bodies to feed to the labyrinth. The modern version, the back rooms, has surveillance footage and missing persons posts and corrupted video files. In both cases, the victim is not killed by wilderness, it is consumed by architecture. Daedalus here is central because he represents the terrifying intelligence behind the built environment. He's not a demon or a god, he's just a craftsman and an engineer. He's a sophisticated designer, and he makes the impossible things practical. According to the myth, the labyrinth was so cunningly made that even Daedalus himself could barely escape it after building it, which is kind of ironic. That detail is even more disturbing than the Minotaur itself, in my opinion, because it suggests a human intelligence capable of creating a system that exceeds human control, that the human cannot escape. And that's one of the oldest anxieties in civilization. What happens when the thing we build becomes smarter than the builder? The Backrooms updates that anxiety for this common modern digital age. Daedalus becomes the anonymous system architect, and the royal palace is now the corporate complex. The Minotaur becomes this unclear danger, and maybe there are entities in the halls, maybe there are creatures in the deeper levels, but the true monster may be the structure itself. But here, the story kind of twists. The labyrinth that we imagine from the myth is usually a branching maze. It's a place of choices and dead ends and confusion. And that makes sense if the purpose is to imprison the Minotaur and kill the victims. But for much of history, the visual symbol of the labyrinth was not branching at all. It was unicursal, one path, no forks, no real choices. This is where the symbol of the spiral comes from. You cannot get lost in it. You can only continue. And that is a very important detail. In common English, labyrinth and maze are often used as if they mean the same thing, but if you actually dig deeper, in specialized usage, a maze is multicursal, with branching choices and dead ends, while a labyrinth is unicursal, with one path to the center and then back. A maze confuses while a labyrinth transforms. A maze will ask you whether you can escape. It will challenge you to do so, but a labyrinth will encourage you to endure the path. And that's where the symbol becomes kind of stranger than the myth. Why would cultures take a monster prison and turn it into a single meditative path? Why would the horror of being trapped become a ritual of walking?
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams sale and get 30% off Super Paint, Super Deck, and Woodscapes products June 12th through the 22nd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
The answer may be that societies domesticate their nightmares by turning them into ceremonies. The labyrinth begins as this prison for a beast, but over time, its pattern starts to appear on pottery and body art and cave walls, even church floors, mosaics, and eventually in hospitals and hospices as a therapeutic walking path in the garden. So what was once the architecture of literal doom becomes the architecture of peaceful contemplation and art. That is not a contradiction. That's just how the symbols survive, in my opinion. A society does not keep a symbol for thousands of years because it has only one meaning. It keeps it because it can absorb a number of things. It can absorb terror and ritual or healing even, initiation. It could absorb death and memory all at once. The labyrinth is a machine that changes meaning depending on who walks it. And I'm sure right about now you might be thinking about the swastika. It's the same concept. For Theseus, the labyrinth is a death trap. But for a pilgrim, it may just be a substitute journey. For a patient in a hospital garden suffering from cancer, it might be this path through suffering where they can contemplate life. For a modern viewer staring at a backroom's hallway, it could be the horrible suspicion that this place has no end and I'm going to die in here. Even the word labyrinth carries this uncertainty. Its origin is probably pre-Greek and its meaning remains hotly disputed. But one famous theory connects it to Labrys, the double-bladed axe. Arthur Evans, who excavated Knossos in the early 20th century, saw double axe symbols in the palace and argued that labyrinth could mean something like the house of the double axe. And he connected the ruins of Knossos and the bull imagery, the double axe, and the Minotaur myth into a single interpretive world. The idea is, of course, powerful, but we do have to treat it kind of carefully. Ancient symbols, they're not always going to obey modern theories. The double axe appears in more than one Cretan palace. Some scholars noted that in Minoan context, it often appears with goddesses or women rather than a male god. The connection between labyrinth and Labrys is quite tempting, but not definitively settled. Still, though, even as a theory, it reveals something that's quite important. The labyrinth is not just about getting lost. It is about entering a sacred technical space marked by power and sacrifice and hidden ritual, much like civilization today. Knossos itself complicates the story because Evans believed the palace helped inspire the myth of the labyrinth. The site has twisting corridors and complex rooms, storage areas and ceremonial spaces. Of course, it has the bull imagery and the famous association with bull leaping. It is quite easy to see why a later imagination could turn such a place into the home of the Minotaur. But not everybody accepts that Knossos was the literal labyrinth. Some researchers have looked elsewhere on Crete, including underground complexes and caves. Scotino Cave has been considered, though it appears naturally formed. Gorton has also been proposed, with tunnels entered through a narrow crack that opens into interlinking chambers that have smooth walls and columns, at least partly shaped by human activity. Those caves later appeared on maps as labyrinthine sites, and during the Second World War, German soldiers even reportedly used the underground spaces for ammunition storage. So this is where myth and archaeology begin to blur, as usual. Maybe the labyrinth was Knossos. Maybe it was Gorton. Maybe it was just a cave. Maybe it was a palace. Maybe it was never one place at all. It was a cultural memory that was formed by several kinds of spaces, like palaces and quarries and tombs and caves, right? And especially bureaucratic architecture. That might be the more unsettling possibility. The labyrinth was not lost because we cannot find the correct ruin. The labyrinth was never merely a ruin. It was a way of reading architecture as danger. But then Egypt enters the story and expands everything, as Egypt tends to do. The Egyptian labyrinth near Lake Moeris is one of the strangest architectural reports in ancient literature. Herodotus claimed that he saw it himself, and he placed it near the city of crocodiles in the Fayum region. He said it surpassed even the pyramids. Think about that claim for a second. For a Greek traveler standing before the monuments of Egypt, the pyramids were already beyond ordinary language, and yet Herodotus is here saying that the labyrinth was greater still. His description makes it sound almost unreal. He says that it had 12 roofed courts, 6 facing north, 6 facing south, a single surrounding wall, 3,000 chambers, half above ground and half below, and he says he personally went through the upper rooms, but the lower rooms were forbidden. The Egyptian keepers would not show them to him because, he was told, they contained the tombs of the kings who built the labyrinth and the tombs of sacred crocodiles. Now, that detail kind of changes the entire atmosphere because the Cretan labyrinth hides a hybrid monster. The Egyptian labyrinth hides kings and sacred crocodiles. It is no longer just a prison. It is a necropolis, a temple complex. It's an administrative structure and a ritual machine. It is a sealed underworld beneath a public monument. It is combining bureaucracy and religion and death and animal worship and architectural confusion into one overwhelming structure. And whenever stories of this come up, I just remember other architecture that has vanished, like the Lighthouse of Alexandria, the Library of Alexandria, and things like that. This is where the Egyptian labyrinth starts to feel disturbingly close to the Backrooms as well. Not because it looks like yellow wallpaper and carpet and fluorescent lights, but because it actually represents a built environment, similarly, that is too large for ordinary human comprehension. Herodotus also describes movement from courts to chambers, chambers to colonnades, colonnades to rooms, rooms back to courts. This is not just a cave. It's not natural. It's designed. It's an environment that has been sophisticatedly designed to exceed the person who enters it. Strabo, writing centuries later, gives us another version. He describes the labyrinth as a great palace composed of many palaces, with courts that are corresponding to the nomes or districts of Egypt. In his account, each district had its own court. So priests and officials, they would gather there for sacrifice and offerings and the administration of justice in whatever serious matters were at hand. The Egyptian labyrinth may have quite literally been remembered not simply as a confusing building, but as Egypt itself translated into architecture. That's a pretty extraordinary idea because it means that a structure existed where every district has its place, a sacred map of the state, a palace of palaces, a ritual bureaucracy in stone. And I personally see the reflection of this in society today still. It's funny how Egypt always ends up in all of these bizarre stories that lead to the understanding that society and civilization is sort of designed after this toxic, designed by this toxic idea and mentality and concept of how to control people, how to control humanity itself. The architecture is designed to be a prison. Strabo says a stranger could not find his way into or out of the courts without a guide because of the winding passages and crypt-like corridors. This is the logic of controlled access. The building is not necessarily impossible for everyone. It is impossible for outsiders. The initiated can move through it just fine. The unauthorized, the people who are strangers to this place, they cannot. That is different from chaos. That is hierarchy expressed as architecture. This is one of the clearest bridges to the back rooms, I think. The horror is not just that the place is in of itself confusing or that there might be something in it. The horror here is that someone or something may understand it perfectly. You are lost because you're not part of the system. Someone else knows the corridors. Someone else has the map and has the permission and access codes and knows where everything goes. Strabo's description grows even more inhuman when he talks about the stonework. He says that the roofs of chambers were made from single enormous stones, and the crypts were roofed with massive slabs. The courts were supported by monolithic pillars, and from above, the roof appeared like a plain, like a big-ass field of stone. It gives the labyrinth a very heavy weight, pardon the pun, because the ceiling itself is not light. It's not something you can break out of. It's not timber. You can't set it on fire. It's not glass. You're not going to be able to break it. It's not fragile. It is a sky made of stone. And the building, it doesn't shelter you from the storm. It presses down on you. Nearby, Strabo describes the sacred crocodile Suchus, which is kept in a lake and fed by the priests there. And visitors often brought offerings of grain and meat and wine. The priests would open the crocodile's mouth and would feed it like it was a living god to them. And this detail of the story is so bizarre that it almost feels invented for horror. A labyrinth of courts and crypts near a city of crocodiles with a tame sacred reptile receiving offerings from human hands. In Crete, the monster is hidden and fed with youths. In Egypt, the sacred crocodile is a public, ritualized god fed by priests and later buried with honors and glory. The monster has become liturgy. Pliny the Elder, writing later, intensifies the whole tradition. He says that the Egyptian labyrinth was the first and that Daedalus used it as the model for the Cretan labyrinth, copying basically just a fraction of it. And he warns readers not to imagine a childish maze or a decorative path. Instead, he says you should picture a building filled with doors and galleries that mislead the visitor and bring him back after all his wandering to the place where he began. This is almost a perfect ancient description of the backrooms. There's the movement without any progress, without knowing where you're going, the corridors that seem to fold in on themselves, a building that converts walking into a severe challenge, and you do not escape because you have moved from one place to another. You simply return to the system's starting point, exhausted and less certain than before, and perhaps, most likely, even more trapped than before. Your mind begins to unravel as you attempt to unravel the labyrinth. Pliny adds more disturbing details. He says some doors produced a dreadful sound like thunder when they were opened, and that many parts had to be crossed in darkness. Beneath other buildings were excavated passages leading to subterranean palaces. And whether every detail is accurate or maybe Pliny exaggerated a little bit, we're getting a pretty unforgettable image here, and one that seems to have transcended time itself, because I went and saw the backrooms in the movie theaters and was thinking about the labyrinth. But these tales of thunder doors and dark halls and underground palaces and carved gods and the statues of the kings of the day and the hideous monsters hidden in this realm and a structure that's so complicated that to describe it is fully impossible, this is something that we keep getting again and again in our timeline. Diodorus Siculus also described the Egyptian labyrinth as less remarkable for size than for ingenuity. A man entering it, he says, cannot easily find the way out without a guide who knows the structure. Again, we see here that the horror is not the bigness alone, the scale of the place. The horror is the design, that the Egyptian labyrinth has an intelligence to it, and that makes it frightening. And then there is Lake Moeris. Herodotus says the labyrinth stood beside this enormous artificial lake connected to the Nile by canal. He describes two pyramids standing in the lake, each rising above the water, with colossal seated statues on top. And he says the water flowed into the lake for 6 months and out again for 6 months, producing revenue from the fish that were caught during the cycle. Whether we accept his measurements literally or not, the mythical image that we're presented with here is absolutely, undeniably massive. Water management, royal treasury, the pyramids, colossal statues, crocodile cults, underground tombs, and a labyrinth of thousands of rooms. This is not a typical experiment of architecture. This is a civilization's control system where water and death and tribute and priesthood and animal gods are all joined into one monumental machine that seems to have persisted to this very day.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
If Crete gives us the labyrinth as monster prison, Egypt gives us the labyrinth as state apparatus. So to sum it up, the Cretan labyrinth says there is a beast hidden beneath power, and the Egyptian labyrinth says power itself may be labyrinthine. It does not need a minotaur. It has courts and priests and crocodiles and forbidden lower levels and all that kind of stuff. It's not one monster in the center. The monster is the entire system. It is what you could call a beast system. And this is exactly where the Backrooms become modern mythology. The Backrooms don't really offer a stable center. There may be entities, there may be levels and maps and rules posted by strangers, but the deeper terror is that no final center actually exists in the Backrooms. You don't reach the middle. You don't kill the beast and then leave. That's the ancient heroic model. The modern model is much, much worse. The building just keeps on going. The architecture never ends, and the levels multiply, and they remember you and reconstruct you in real time. The exits are rumored to exist, and then upon arriving, there's nothing there. The maps contradict one another. There's no real way to figure out where you are at any given time except by some sort of subconscious GPS that you've got going on. I don't know, that's the best way I could describe it while I was playing the video games. Every answer becomes just another corridor. The Backrooms are the labyrinth after the center has disappeared. And I think that that shift in mythology tells us something about the evolution of fear. Coincidentally, I wrote an episode called The Evolution of Fear before I wrote this, and I chose to tell you guys this story instead. So we'll go down the road of the evolution of fear a little more in depth in another episode, but ancient people often imagined terror as a concealed presence of something, a monster in the cave, a dragon, a god behind the veil, some sort of beast that lives under the palace, the sacred crocodile in the lake. And modern people increasingly imagine terror as a concealed absence of something. Empty offices, dead malls, a vacated arena, unstaffed corridors, endless neutral rooms, the whole left behind kind of vibe, systems without faces and bureaucracy without a king. There's no head of the snake to cut off. The horror is not that somebody is watching you from some high up throne. It's that there might not be really any throne at all, and you are just forced to follow these procedures endlessly, getting deeper and deeper in this labyrinth until you really are having a hard time figuring out where you are and what to do about it. In the Theseus myth, Ariadne gives the hero a thread so that he can find his way back after killing the Minotaur. And this might be the most important symbol in the entire labyrinth tradition. The thread symbolizes memory, and it is made physical. It is the line between the self and the world. It is proof that return is possible from whence you came. And Theseus survives because he doesn't just enter the labyrinth. He remains connected to the outside. He is in the world, but he is not of the world. In Backrooms mythology, people cling to video footage and logs and maps and things scribbled on the wall and recorded warnings and even forum entries and stuff like that. The thread is not a piece of wool. It is a camera file. It is a corrupted upload or a diagram that is drawn by somebody who may already be dead, possibly eaten by the Backrooms. But they function as the same thing, and it's kind of easy to see that. When reality becomes recursive, you need a line back to what is real. You need to be connected to reality. You cannot allow yourself to just disappear into the labyrinth because you may never come out. The problem is that modern threads are very fragile and people are increasingly fickle. A ball of string it's not going to lie to you. But a digital file can be corrupted or made by AI. A video can be edited. The guides could be wrong. In the ancient labyrinth, the thread is a sort of promise of return. But in the backrooms, the thread itself might actually be part of the trap. And that just shows you, or it parables, if you will, how society itself is becoming more and more of a threat to the everyday adventurer of society. The labyrinth is not just Greek or Egyptian. It appears across cultures because it speaks to something older than one single myth. In the Tohono O'odham tradition of the Sonoran Desert, the man in the maze, often associated with Liatoi, presents the maze as a symbol of life's journey. And if I said that stuff wrong, I'm sorry. More than likely I did. But the figure stands at the entrance, and the path winds inward through difficulty and choice and transformation. This is not just another monster prison. It is a symbol of existence itself. The maze is the biography of man, and to walk it is to live. In Indian tradition, the Chakravaya from the Mahabharata offers another sort of variation. It is not just architecture, it is considered a sort of battle formation. Abhimanyu knows how to enter the formation, but he doesn't know how to get out of it. He can't escape. And the story gives us one of the most brutal labyrinth themes. Knowledge of entry is not the same as knowledge of exit. A doorway is not a promise. Many, many systems are designed to be easier to enter than to leave. In modern times, you could say all systems are that way. Financial, medical, educational, spiritual. These systems, they are crafted meticulously to lure you in, to be easy to enter, and very hard to escape. That principle applies quite literally everywhere, from cults to bureaucracies to debt systems, digital platforms, social media, institutions, wars, ideologies. The exit is always a conditional thing, while the entrance is very well marked with bright lights and welcome in signs. In the far north, the stone labyrinths of the Sulawesi Islands add another layer. They were built from boulders on cold islands in the White Sea, and to this day, their exact purpose remains uncertain. Some think that they had ritual uses, or, you know, provided some kind of connections to the dead, or traps for spirits, maybe symbolic passages between this world and another. But even if we cannot settle these interpretations, the pattern is still familiar. A labyrinth is placed at a boundary. Land and sea, life and death, the known and the unknown, the human world and the other world. This might be the oldest function of the labyrinth. This marker of thresholds, this form to transition. A lot of people think the spiral is just a symbol of life, and in its most simple form, you could say that, because it represents often things like birth, death, initiation and judgment and pilgrimage and even madness and chaos. The path coils because transformation is rarely straight. And what else coils? Like deception, a snake. Now, let's go back to the backrooms. The backrooms are usually described as liminal spaces. These are places in between other places. A dead mall is not wilderness, but it is also no longer fully commerce. You could call it a concrete jungle. An empty office is not somebody's home, but it will still have the residue of humanity within it. Perhaps a family photo, or maybe something from home, like a houseplant that you brought there to give it a more homey vibe. A hallway is supposed to connect meaningful rooms. A hallway is a liminal space that brings you from point A to point B. People do not hang out in hallways. But in the back rooms, the hallway is the destination and it is ever changing, one hallway to another. The transitional space is completely detached from purpose and it begins to reproduce itself over and over and over. That is what makes it so unnerving. The back rooms are all threshold with nowhere to arrive. Ancient labyrinths, they had these centers, as we've kind of outlined. Even when frightening, they did imply a certain meaning. At the center, there was a minotaur or a tomb or a god or a crocodile, right? The back rooms threaten us with a world where the center has been evacuated completely. You can wander forever and find nothing any more meaningful than you've already seen. Just more infrastructure that never ends. But perhaps that's not the absence of myth. That is the myth that fits our age. The symbol adapted. The ancient labyrinth was a very sacred architecture. The Egyptian labyrinth was bureaucratic, sacred architecture. The backrooms, I consider, a secular architecture after the sacred has been removed, but the trap remains. It is a church without a god. The gods are gone, or at least so we're told. The kings are nowhere to be seen, and neither are their priests, and yet the corridors and the gates remain. And the administrative logic behind all of this also still remains. The forbidden lower levels, they're still there, and there is a guide system, but who is the guide, and where are they guiding me to, and when will they arrive, and when will we arrive wherever we are being allegedly guided to? The feeling that someone understands the structure better than you remains from antiquity to the backrooms. Maybe the modern times did not destroy the labyrinth. It just stripped the symbols off the walls and painted them yellow, keeping the entire mechanism intact. This is why the backrooms just hit so hard for me, I think. And maybe this is just me because I am a literal crazy person, but they reveal the spiritual condition of a world that thinks it has outgrown myth while living inside mythic structures. We still have labyrinths. We just call them systems now. We still have the minotaurs. We call them anomalies. We call them entities and accidents and classified programs. You know, emergent behaviors and failures of the institutions. We still have sacrifices. We just consider them, or at least call them, acceptable losses and whatnot. I would consider people with faith that there is more beyond this realm to still have Ariadne's thread that would lead them out of the labyrinth. The ancient person feared being fed to the beast beneath the palace. They feared the teeth and the claws that would tear them to pieces and turn them into a meal. The modern person fears discovering that their palace, this palace that they are in, I guess it's not even their palace unless they consider it their home, but they fear that this palace never ends. These corridors will never bring them to the place that they want to be. And what's interesting about this is when I talk about the afterlife, or when I talk about heaven, or what comes next when we die, people get discouraged sometimes at the concept of living forever in a perfect state where all they have to do is worship God. But when it comes to this civilization we're in now, which is almost directly mirroring the backrooms and the labyrinth, they have very few qualms about living in it for a few years as it slowly suffocates them to death.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And somewhere in that endless architecture between the Greek monsters and the Egyptian crocodile gods and the stone maze and the battle formation, between the sacred paths and the hospital gardens where the cancer patients walk in their final moments, the dead mall that has been turned into a maze of concrete and metal, and the fluorescent yellow rooms of the back rooms, the same old question waits. Did we build this labyrinth to contain the monster? Or did we build the labyrinth because the monster taught us how? Thanks for listening. The life is in the blood.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.